Hello and welcome to another edition of Bunker Daily, the daily information injection sibling to Wednesday's full panel data life support machine. I am your host, Alex Andreu. There is, of course, value to big picture retrospection when one emerges from a crisis. I found this when I wrote up my investigation of Cobra meetings and daily press conferences in February and March for the Byline Times. But there is also value to understanding the speed and heat of a moment for people who were in the middle of it. My guest today is the author of Duty of Care, a searing read that seeks to impart precisely that speed and heat of the coronavirus pandemic as it unfolded in the UK. An eminent cardiologist, he hit the news when he resigned over Dominic Cummings breaking lockdown rules and refusing to relinquish his post or even accept responsibility and apologise. He is also the founder of the charity Heroes, to which all royalties from the book will go, and which has delivered over 500,000 units of PPE to frontline staff, has dedicated a 350,000 fund to researching sustainable reusable PPE, and has set up a support grant to fund healthcare workers needing help with everything from mental health to childcare. Dr. Dominic Pimenta, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the bunker, especially knowing, having read the book, how scarce your free time is.
Well, thanks for having me, Alex. and actually, making obvious time for interviews and things to talk about the book. But that's some very kind words. And listening to you reading it back to me, yes, I suppose I have been somewhat busy, I suppose.
Yes. Talking of the speed and heat of the moment, I was struck by a passage in your book which described hospitals at the time as taking on properties of time and space all of their own. Mm. You were describing an almost inception-like situation where every time you went in for a shift, wards had closed, wards had opened, wards had moved, locker rooms were in a different place, and procedures had altered radically. How was it trying to do your job to save lives in the middle of such panic and flux?
Yeah, it was, and I think that it felt like going and trying to work in a Rubik's cube that someone was sort of furiously twisting every day. Sometimes I've never missed a shift in my entire career until about the third or fourth weekend in the pandemic, when the rota had changed five times in the week, and someone phoned me and said, "Aren't you supposed to be at work today?" And I literally hadn't checked it that day. I think it may give a sense of not necessarily panic. So where we worked, we had the capacity to keep moving, to keep expanding. And I wrote about that in the book as we expanded our intensive care from one to two to three to four, so quadrupling capacity. And it was a great, a great privilege, really, to see that in motion, and my small part as a cog on the ground more than anything else, not really doing anything, trying to manage this huge logistic beast to save as many lives as you say as possible.
So the much maligned NHS managers deserve quite a lot of credit.
Yeah, and I think so. And I think it's an interesting, much maligned managers. There's oft this phrase of, and I've looked at this before, there's a phrase of there's too many managers in the NHS. But actually, if you look at business, I think it's about one manager per six employees. And in the NHS, it's about 30 employees per manager. So if anything, we have less managers than we probably should. But what was interesting is, as busy as maybe my life reads during the time, that was probably true of nearly every healthcare professional to some degree. Everybody was doing double or triple time and taking on duties after duties. I think there was a particularly enraging Telegraph headline that talked about how the NHS couldn't cope, or the lockdown was because the NHS couldn't cope. And nothing could really be further from the truth. I've never witnessed the speed and incredible movement of people to respond in such a vast problem, nationally and actually internationally. There's a good example I write about in the book of a colleague of mine who'd actually applied to move a clock, a clock nailed to a wall or whatever, for 3 years, and that clock was still in the wrong place. But the same hospital managed to build a 16-bed resuscitation unit in their A&E waiting room in 3 days. So there's something to be said for, when needs must, the NHS was there. And I think that's a really key message of the book, this idea that, A, we couldn't cope is incorrect, but also how we coped. So there's also this narrative of the NHS wasn't overwhelmed. You know, the
yes, and you say very clearly it was overwhelmed.
Yes, yeah. And we essentially we cannibalized ourselves to cope with that. You know, we cancelled electives. We moved rooms around that previously were being used for other purposes. And we massively redistributed staff. I mean, you know, lots of different staff from not just myself, but from all over the hospitals and lots of hospitals and nurses as well. And as a doctor, it's a smallish jump to be redistributed around. We're kind of used to doing that. And I'm relatively junior, so I've done that quite a lot already, bouncing between departments. But many of the nurses would have worked on the same ward, never mind the same hospital, the same ward. For maybe a decade or more, and they were just as willing and just as sort of what's the word, sleeves rolled up, I guess, to be working.
I hope your colleague took this opportunity to move the clock and blame it on the general COVID.
I think they knocked the wall down. I think that's actually what happened.
Excellent. So to take you back in time, you describe how back in January, I think it was, your very first gut reaction, before you knew the source of the news, was it was fake news. And how gradually you became interested. And I was struck by, you know, as a medical professional, because this isn't your field of expertise, how similar to what everyone else was doing, what you were doing was, you know, you were Googling and looking at the research and keeping an eye on things, albeit with a better capacity to understand it than a layperson. And how when you started wearing a mask on public transport, which was in mid-February, you felt self-conscious, having scoffed at people wearing them in the past. Why do you think we have such an active anti-masker movement in this country still, and how do we deal with it?
I mean, that's a very difficult question to answer, really. And I think it is, if you draw sort of a Venn diagram of the anti-maskers and the anti-vaccinators, I'd imagine it would be one and the same. I think it speaks to maybe a broader issue with not just this country, but almost all of potential Western and I don't know, beyond Western civilization, which is we don't seem to be able to cope with the level of information we have access to. We don't quite have grown into the adolescence of the internet, and misinformation is now so rife that we've started to, you know, to disbelieve everything, you know, the basic science of medicine, and at the same time quite happy to tweet about that, you know, mistrust in science on the iPhone, you know, using the 4G network. So there's this cognitive dissonance, and I wrote about this in the book about what some people hold, and that's true in different respects. And I've sort of lost hope that we are rational human beings in general. But when issues of extreme importance come, what I really worry about is how easily it becomes a diversifying issue, a divergent issue where people will take sides and generally drawing sides, different issues, but the same people on the same sides, and how we reach across that divide. And I think the internet sort of foments some of these ideas, this misinformation that is incredibly dangerous. And we sort of saw that in reality. I mean, the pandemic, believe it or not, and there's lots of reports of, you know, coronavirus hoaxes,
hoaxes
coming to harm. But the reality is that's always been the case. It's just, this is just a more obvious situation. And it's one, I think, probably the greatest challenge of our, you know, generation, and that extends to all the other challenges that face us, climate change, pandemics, etc., is how do we get people to believe in the same facts before even we decide what to do? I think Obama put it best. We used to, you know, have different opinions about what to do, and now we actually can't even agree on the basic facts. And I think as a doctor especially, that's particularly infuriating, because what I often see is patients who are very vigorously holding these, you know, anti-scientific, anti-medicine beliefs, but at the drop of a hat, they're ill and they're in hospital. And then all those beliefs don't last very long. Yeah. So when the shit hits the fan, that's where they are.
It seemed to me time and time again in the book that what you described was a lag between the best data we had and the guidance coming from government. So, for instance, there's a point after we knew there was community transmission, after we had the first actual case of someone who hadn't traveled anywhere or come into contact with anyone that had traveled. And you talk about a patient presenting symptoms whom you still couldn't test because the guidance days later was still, we only test people who have traveled.
Hmm.
The same thing happened with care homes. You know, there's an incident where you couldn't be tested because you hadn't shaved in the last few hours. The criteria for sending patients to Nightingale hospitals was that they have to have one organ failing, and you had patients that had no organs failing and two organs failing. Did those 60,000 ONS deaths brew in that gap between the best information we have available and the state moving to put it into effect?
I think the delay, certainly. I mean, and that's, you know, we were calling for specifically for early lockdown on the 16th of March, and nothing of significance happened for another week. And I think some of the estimates for about half those deaths occurred from that delay alone, because it's an exponential curve.
Yeah.
So at that point, and the other thing with the case numbers is there's this sort of incubation period, which at the time we thought was probably about 2 weeks. It's probably a bit less than that, about 7 days. But that means once the virus is abroad, the numbers continue to double, regardless of what you do, for approximately a week to 2 weeks.
Mm.
So there's always this, you know, that lag is almost built into the process. So if you're reacting to the case numbers and hoping that you can affect something tomorrow, well, actually, you need to be reacting 2 weeks prior. So there's that issue. There did seem to be this strange difficulty in, you know, not just in what the best data was, but what was happening on the ground. Like, we were seeing cases, you know, community cases quite regularly in London. And either they didn't have a diagnosis or the diagnosis was significantly delayed. And, you know, it was far from me the only person thinking about this. There were very many colleagues thinking, well, this is coronavirus, I'm going to treat it regardless. And that is a sort of trait of many doctors, to just think, you know, the guidelines are the guidance, but I'm the doctor here and I'm going to do this. But there was a lot of resistance to doing that. And it's not as straightforward, I suppose, as saying, you know, I'm the doctor, I want to test, because it has a lot of implications. You know, if you start testing everybody for coronavirus very early on unnecessarily, well, you use capacity, but also you then mandate, you know, the movement of patients around in hospital where resources are pretty tight and generate a significant amount of anxiety. So there is a fine balance. But, you know, in retrospect, and even at the time, it was obvious that we got the balance wrong. And it wasn't quite clear what the rationale was for the guidance to not change or be disseminated, whether that was a logistic issue, whether that was a deliberate issue in regards to capacity or some other reason. And I suppose that would be one of the key questions. What did happen, you know, in that week between sort of March the 11th and March the 23rd? Those 2 weeks were probably responsible for all that excess death that's put us at the top of the tables, the worst league tables for excess death in the world. And where the key decisions were made, and you know, what was deliberate, what was miscommunicated, and what was a mistake.
The Nightingale hospitals, you describe your encounters with a colleague that was very excited by them, and you seem to be slightly less so. The Excel Centre one has now been won down, having had at its peak, I think it was 14 patients at any one time in it, a hospital that was designed to take a possible 4,000 people. Was this a timing issue? Were they just too late because we misjudged when the peak would be? Or were they Potemkin villages for ministers to have their photo taken in front of?
That's a good question. And I have to say my opinion veers between all of those various points. I suppose on the broader level, you know, it had capacity in theory, you know, in terms of beds for 4,000 patients. I very much doubt it had staff for 4,000 patients without significantly draining other parts of the country or other parts of London. Because the one thing that we don't have and have never really had, you can create as many physical beds as you want, but you can't create ICU nurses, you can't create ICU doctors. You can try very hard, but you know, I was never what I would consider an ICU.
You can retrain people as you did.
Yeah, but to some extent, you know, I can press some of the buttons.
But there's a ceiling to it. There's a physical ceiling to it. I'm keen to move to the more personal aspects of the book. You don't mention this and you never complain about it, but collecting the anecdotes you mention, and I know this also from my brother-in-law, who's a doctor, at times like this, you seem to become personally a hub for everyone's worries. Families, friends, neighbors, acquaintances, they look at you as some sort of font of all COVID-19 wisdom. That pressure must have been immense.
Yeah, and I suppose, well, you know, as you mentioned, your brother-in-law, I think there's doctors take two different paths on this. I certainly know some doctors that will literally shut any family communication down. They won't talk about anything medical at all. And I've always taken the opposite route. I don't know why. I suppose, you know, I've been, regardless of the COVID, being personally involved in lots of medical problems for lots of members of my family. And I just guess, what would I want, you know, if I wasn't a doctor, some advocate. And I also know the intricacies of the NHS and the difficulties. So I've always been that person, not just being in COVID. And me and my wife, both doctors. So we tend to sort of, you know, trade places for each other's family, because it's very hard to be, you know, properly objective. And not in the way of treating family members, but, you know, helping them navigate and speaking to their problems. And, you know, ears prick up at a family gathering, you say, well, that doesn't sound right. Why didn't you get that checked out? Or similar. And then obviously, you know, I became so, bunkered in with COVID from many different aspects, you know, from the beginning, from calling for lockdown, and then through the charity and PPE stuff. So it was, but I suppose I just thought of it as part of, you know, part of the job.
Part of the job. Quite a profession,
you know, not just a job.
You say, I'm not very good at emotions. I find it hard to connect the inner and outer spheres. I was struck by a moment in the midst of all this where you and your wife actually started making your wills, because frontline healthcare staff were dying at that point. Do you think that level of detachment is how healthcare staff survive such situations?
I think there is an element of professional detachment. I wrote a thread a few years ago about, is medicine a job or not? And I think I came to the conclusion that if you don't treat it like a job and you don't detach yourself, then you're too, you know, you see too much life with a capital L, you know, too many death, birth, trauma, major risk, you know, and there's a few moments now that still haunt me throughout my career. You're taught an element of clinical detachment from emergency scenarios for good reason. You know, you have to go and do the cardiac arrest. You have to know the cogs to save somebody's life or not, as the case may be. But what you're not really taught particularly well is how to deal with the patient's grief, with your own grief. And I suppose, whether that's a function of being a bloke or a function of me specifically or of the profession, I don't know. But there's always been this element of a slight, sometimes surprise, I think, of that I'm always sort of taken aback by my own feelings. And I won't particularly react. I remember a long time ago, a young family member was very, very sick, very, very suddenly. And I ended up almost having to resuscitate them while the ambulance came. And at the time, I was completely in doctor mode, you know, someone I was very close to, a young boy, and didn't think of anything above it at all, other than, you know, I need to sort this out, sort the breathing out, you know, get the ambulance in. And he turned out to be fine, and I was completely fine. Everyone's like, aren't you, like, completely freaked out? Because, you know, his mum, everything was just shouting and screaming. And then I just remember going home and just having, like, feeling sick and vomiting, but not really feeling anything. And I thought, is this how I process emotions? Like, I don't connect to the inner, but it goes somewhere else. And throughout my career, I've had funny, you know, stomach bleeds and inflammation of the heart and, you know,
back pain. you store it all elsewhere.
Yeah, it's all somatic and it will go somewhere else. And that's why I always wonder, like, am I just digging this down and not addressing it? And I think that is a real almost analogy for what has happened to the NHS overall. Mm. You know, we've been through a massive trauma as a healthcare system. And that staff haven't really had time to breathe because the work's still there. And there's a lot of work, especially through the charity now, to try and make sure that we preserve as many staff as possible and we don't end up losing a whole bunch of staff, potentially in the midst of the next, you know, the next wave or the next pandemic. Mm.
And at the time when you took a stand about Dominic Cummings breaking lockdown, You were attacked by right-wing press and websites like Guido Fawkes, essentially for not resigning enough, because apparently you didn't relinquish your national training number, essentially dropping out of the profession altogether immediately. I mean, how frustrating is it to be doing all that and at the same time be basically trolled?
Yeah, and I think that is the one. So it's interesting that the Guido stuff, I actually just found their archive very recently and they've got a whole archive on me. And most of it is rubbish. Like, most of it's factually incorrect. I think they've quoted me saying something which is actually a Guardian article, which I have nothing to do with. I don't even know where that's attributed to. So it's a bit worrying. But equally, you know, in March, I was writing articles and getting a lot of similar negative, you know, you're sensationalist, opportunistic, self-promoting. And I think it sort of just comes, you know, with the territory. And if you want to, and there was a lot of, you know, personal blowback and professional blowback as well from that, you know, from speaking out on March 16th, etc., which, to be honest, in retrospect, was not controversial in the slightest. So I sort of expected it. But equally, you know, if you want to be affecting something in the national conversation, you have to understand that there's lots of fractious opinions and very strong opinions on both sides, and that's the nature of the conversation. And it, just to be part of the, you know, part of the territory is the lay of the land, and it is an unfortunate part of our
conversation. But there's a sentence towards the end of the book that really sort of imprinted on me. You write, "All I've ever wanted is to be wrong about all this." Do you think the right people have learned the right lessons, or is there a lazy assumption that the NHS stepped in to save us and they can step in to save us again during a second or third or fourth wave?
I think that's a really important point. And part of what the furious drive to write the book, because it was sort of about 6 weeks of writing, which is pretty fast, was to try and get that message out as soon as possible before the second wave. I mean, if we're going to learn any lessons, we need to learn them now. There's no point, you know, waiting for the inquiry until the pandemic's over, because we potentially will lose twice as many lives projected in the reasonable worst case scenario over this winter if there is a second wave. And I think, and what's very frustrating even over the summer was this rewriting of the narrative, you know, saying we did lock down on time, we have performed well. And I think that didn't really land for many reasons, mostly because the numbers, unfortunately, are the numbers and they're fairly immutable. You know, the worst economic hit and the worst hit from the virus. But what we really, and what fundamentally, I suppose, the mistake has always been is this sort of paternalistic lack of transparency attitude from government, and not really just giving the basics to people and saying, look, this is the virus. Yes, it's a terrible situation. But we still are getting, you know, sloganeering. All the schools must be open, despite schools being a very different and heterogeneous group. And I think that particular lesson hasn't been learned at all. And that very much worries me for what happens in the next.
I was locked down in Greece for some of this, with shielding my mother, who is elderly and has Alzheimer's. And I was struck by the difference between the daily briefing in the UK, which I watched every day, and it happened to be just after the daily briefing in Greece. And the daily briefing in Greece was always science-led, effectively. And the daily briefing in the UK always seemed like a party political broadcast. So I think there's some validity to the people who say that this was partly treated not as a public health emergency, but as a PR crisis. I don't want to give the wrong impression about your book. I have focused on the dramatic, of course, for this interview, but it contains a really hopeful message, you know, about the kindnesses you witnessed and the humanity everywhere and the incredible response of staff. For example, a group of plastic surgeons got together and designed a better mask, you know, so that people would be more comfortable while working. What is next for the charity Heroes, and how can people help?
I mean, that's a great question. So the issue, I suppose, we're facing, we had this meeting only a few days ago in my new role as the chairman, is we don't know what's going to happen. If the pandemic returns, then our role is much more acute, and we'll be across delivering food and ramping up PPE production again and looking at novel ways to help in that respect. And if it doesn't, or it's less, you know, less difficult to deal with on the ground, then our predominant role will be supporting the welfare and well-being, and the focus really to be trying to preserve lots of the welfare measures that were put in place. You know, the night food. I think I said this in the book, but you know, chips, hot chips at 2 a.m. I think should be a human right, and that really is. I mean, that really is the case. It's such a morale boosting thing. And, you know, I think the IPPR at the beginning of the pandemic estimated about 300,000 staff were considering leaving. And I'm sure that number must be considerably higher after the pandemic.
Yeah.
And that's catastrophe. I mean, that's economic catastrophe, that's societal catastrophe. So if we don't be the champions of how to best support staff and keep them in their jobs and keep them well supported so they can do their jobs, then I think that will be the chief function that determines if the NHS lives or dies, if I'm honest. Mm. So what we've been trying to do in the last, you know, couple of weeks is how we build that network. Because what we struggled with initially was we came from nowhere. So trying to get into hospitals and actually trying to engage with staff was very difficult with so much noise. So we're actually launching in the next couple of weeks a membership platform to try and sign up NHS staff, and then reaching out to business to start to consolidate some of those, you know, the discounts, the freebies, the stuff that really made a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
But also access to all our services and trying to work out what people need and when they need it. So counselling particularly, we've been pushing quite hard and delivering sort of 600 hours a week of counselling. And then what's interesting with the PPE side is that we've now probably got capacity to create a sort of reusable, sustainable uniform. You know, that includes visor, gown, scrubs, and to some extent a mask as well. And how we go about testing that and getting that ready and safe. So the visor has a CE mark, and we're doing similar things with other parts of PPE. And lots of people in the charity have said, Dom, you're crazy, the pandemic's over. And I've pushed very hard to say, well, it might be over, but actually it might not be. And if we produce a war chest and keep it, there's no harm in selling that all in January.
And how do we know there's not another pandemic in 2 years' time?
Well, precisely. And actually, what would we have wanted to have done in February? We should do that now. And if we're wrong, we're wrong. And that's not such a big deal. There's ways of, you know, recouping that money. It's not such a problem. But if we don't do that, then we get stuck again. I think that's unforgivable. So that's kind of what we're thinking.
What's the website address where people can...
Yeah, so it's helpthemhelpus.co.uk. You can donate directly on the website. And, you know, obviously donations will be hugely helpful in funding all of these activities. And what's interesting about being, you know, a novel charity sort of outside the NHS traditional structures, we can do things innovatively and research-based that many other sort of traditional charities can't. And I hope that becomes a sort of new, almost charity 2.0 model, I guess, for how we deliver services and how we be as effective as possible.
Yes, I doubt the traditional charity CEO spends much time in the wee hours of the morning washing washing goggles in a print farm. Yeah. Dominic, I cannot thank you enough, not just for this illuminating half hour, but for everything you did and continue to do. Please know that for every troll, there are people like me to whom you are a bona fide superhero.
Well, I think that's an exaggeration, but that's very kind. And actually, you know, compliments are always appreciated, you know, to deal with the trolls. So thank you very much.
And listeners, remember there's a new Bunker Daily every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday mornings, with a longer weekly episode featuring a full panel every Wednesday morning. So don't forget to subscribe, review and rate us on Apple Podcasts, and please support us if you can on the funding platform Patreon, where you can search for the Bunker Podcast. Stay socially distant but emotionally available. This is Alex Andreu in the Bunker, saying over and out for now.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Alex Andreu. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold. And audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.